This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's been a week since the tragic derailment of Amtrak Train 188. 8 people are dead, hundreds more injured, and as tragic as this accident was, it was by no means an isolated incident. In the first 2 months of 2015 alone, Amtrak had 18 accidents. Now we've learned this most recent crash and possibly others might have been avoided. An existing system called PTC, or Positive Train Control, could have slowed the speeding train to an appropriate speed, keeping it on track around the fatal curve.
Until we know for certain what caused this tragedy, I just want to reiterate what I have already said, that we are a growing country with a growing economy. We need to invest in the infrastructure that keeps us that way, and not just when something bad happens, like a bridge collapse or a train derailment, but all the time. That's what great nations do.
That's President Obama speaking on what's been an unfortunate and ongoing theme and our hesitancy to invest in infrastructure. But was cost the only factor in keeping Positive Train Control from being implemented? Now that we've witnessed what can happen without it, might we start seeing the technology in more places along the Northeast Corridor and around America? We're going to be talking with experts in trains and safety. We're going to be asking this question and many of yours at 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear from you, your thoughts about the safety of our rail system today, what questions you have about it. You can always find us online, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us first by phone is Anna Radlatt. She's Washington correspondent for the Connecticut Mirror. She's been writing about Connecticut and positive train control and about rail safety in the Northeast Corridor. Anna, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
What are you hearing in Washington today, the reaction to the crash last week, and what lawmakers are saying about what needs to be done?
Well, it depends on what party you belong to. The Amtrak crash has also fallen prey to the partisanship in Congress. Democrats want more money for Amtrak, and they want faster implementation of positive train control everywhere. Republicans want the opposite. They voted hours after the crash to cut money for Amtrak, and they're looking to delay the Congress's deadline for implementation of positive train control.
And the deadline was supposed to be by essentially this year, but it's being pushed off. What is the reason being given for pushing off a deadline, especially at a time when we're seeing accidents like the one we just saw?
Well, the biggest problem is the money, is the expense that railroads don't want to use. But they also have other issues they raise. They say, how do you test? You know, there's questions about testing. There's a question about implementation. They feel the technology, can be implemented several ways, and they think that Congress hasn't given them a clear mandate on how to implement positive train control or test it.
So how big are the numbers here, whether it's to test it or to implement it? I mean, what kind of money are we talking about, Anna?
Well, let me put it this way. Just to put some of the technology on its tracks, Metro North borrowed nearly $1 billion from the Federal Railroad Administration. We could safely say it's billions and billions of dollars to put this coast to coast.
When we started looking at the maps that newspapers and others were putting together following this crash last week, we saw this patchwork across the Northeast, including right here in Connecticut. Some parts of our rail system have positive train control, Anna. Others don't. Does this have to do with who owns the lines, with who's paying the bills? Why this patchwork approach?
Frankly, I do not know. That's a question for the railroads. In Connecticut, for example, Amtrak owns some of the lines, but it has positive train control on its line from New Haven to Boston, but not from New Haven to Springfield. And the other tracks that are owned by the state, which is an anomaly, usually states don't own tracks, railroads do, but because of a long, it's too complicated for me to get into it now, but Connecticut owns part of the tracks in the state. They have not implemented positive train control on any of those tracks.
Well, let me turn to Stephen Segedy. He's a former electrical engineer for the Department of Transportation here in Connecticut, former Connecticut State DOT representative to Metro North's Positive Train Control Committee. He understands this stuff better than just about anyone, so we wanted to bring him in to talk with him about this. Stephen, welcome to the program, first of all.
Oh, thank you very much.
First of all, before we get into some details about why PTC might be in some places as opposed to others, how exactly does it work? What does it do?
PTC basically sends an indication of the track condition to the train engineer. The train engineer either responds to it via a computer system on the train, or if he doesn't respond to it, the computer system takes over and responds to it. It's very simple in that respect.
It's very simple. And how is it implemented? It's simple, but it obviously if it was so simple, then we'd probably have it everywhere. I mean, explain a little bit more about it.
Well, Positive Train Control has transponders in Europe. They're called balises, and they have a set condition of what the track is in front of it, and it is transmitted either through a GPS location, via satellite or an antenna along the right-of-way. Nationwide, there are probably going to be 36,000 antennas put up to transmit the information. Along Metro North's right-of-way, there will be antennas on catenary structures, poles that will be put up, and the antenna will transmit the information from the balise that has the condition of what the track condition is in front of the engineer, the speed that is needed to approach that particular area, whether it is a switch, whether it's a turnout, there are complicated things to it, but the idea is to give the information to the train. The engineer either is responding to the information that he's receiving, or the computer system will take that control of the train away from him.
And that's one of the important things. If for some reason the conductor of the train, the engineer of the train is incapacitated, all of a sudden there's no human response, then the train would just do it on its own.
Actually, the train will go into, it will shut down. It will stop the train. If the engineer is incapacitated, then the train will shut down.
So one of the questions we've been hearing the last couple of days as far as cost in implementing this is you got all these antennas all over the place. There's a cost there, but there's a bandwidth consideration, right? I mean, you're going to take a certain amount of data to actually move over these lines however you do it. Is that part of the holdup?
Yes, it is. Currently, Amtrak uses from New Haven to Boston the 900 megahertz frequency, which they've been allocated to use for Positive Train Control. Now, the FCC mandated that the railroads move to a 217 megahertz frequency, 217 to 220. Now, that frequency was auctioned off. It is the responsibility of the railroads to acquire that frequency now.
So we auctioned that off to make some money?
I believe so.
And now we've got to essentially buy it back, kind of like some of the rail lines that we had in the state, and then we tore up, and then we're having to rebuild again for our commuter rail system?
Yes.
So sort of like that. So we paid once for it, we ripped it up, and then we're paying again for it. I mean, it sounds like one of the things that's standing in our way, not so much is the technology or the cost, but it is us. What's standing in the way is our past behavior.
It may be. We have neglected our infrastructure for the last 50 to 100 years, and that's a major thing. The infrastructure, not only for the railroads, for the highways, for the bridges, we have to invest in it. Another problem of it is that there's so much red tape that we have to go through to do this.
Well, that's one of the things that the Republican senators who have been extending this PTC mandate, one of the things that they've been saying is there's so much red tape. I mean, look, we can't just ask the railroad system to just do this overnight. There's an awful lot that we're asking to be done. Is it reasonable to say that it's going to take enough time that maybe we shouldn't be doing it right now?
We don't have the time to really do this. I mean, it was mandated by Congress that it should be in place by 2015. I don't believe we're going to make the mandate. Some separate railroads may make a particular mandate, but to make a nationwide mandate, it is very difficult for us to do that. Right now, we spent about $6 billion. We're going to spend upwards of $10 billion to put this in. The technology hasn't been fully developed. The suppliers aren't there. We don't even have American suppliers to build all the equipment we need.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about the aftermath of the Amtrak crash outside Philadelphia last week and what it's teaching us about rail safety in the Northeast and also around the country. Joining us in studio is Stephen Segedy, who's a former engineer for the DOT. Anna Radlad is a Washington correspondent for the Connecticut Mirror, who's been covering this out of Washington. And I think one of the important things about this is we're looking at this, obviously, from a very Northeast-centered perspective. There's a lot more people who ride on Amtrak in the Northeast Corridor and then commuter rail lines like Metro North than just about any place else in the country. But there are a lot of concerns in the Midwest and certainly in California, where there was a terrible accident some years ago. What are lawmakers around the rest of the country saying about this problem that we're now seeing cropping up in the Northeast?
Well, I think you hit it on the head. It depends on how, you know, whether Amtrak crosses your state. I mean, there are states out there that are not in the Northeast and have Amtraks. For instance, Mississippi has three Amtrak lines crisscrossing the state. And its lawmakers are very supportive of Amtrak. So I guess it's, you know, whether you have passenger rail, you're more apt to care about Amtrak than if you don't have it.
Anna Radlad is Washington correspondent for the Connecticut Mirror. Anna, as always, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to welcome in Robert Halstead. He's a railroad industry expert and crash investigator. He's with Ironwood Technologies in Syracuse, New York. He's also president of the National Association of Railroad Safety Consultants and Investigators. Robert Halstead, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you broader questions about why trains crash sometimes later in the program. But first, are we viewing positive train control as a kind of panacea here? If only this got done, this would solve a lot of our problems?
Well, you know, what we often find in railroad accident reconstruction is that an accident is the product of an interlinked chain of events. And oftentimes, if you remove one or more of the links, the accident does not occur. So there are a wide variety of things that cause railroad accidents. You can have track failure, signal failure. You can have equipment failure, locomotives and cars. But you can also have human failure. And it's human failure that positive train control is primarily designed to deal with.
What do we know about human failure, about how often trains and the people who are driving them make some sort of bad decision causing accidents? I mean, is it really human error more than anything else?
In my experience, you know, I can give you off the, you know, the back of the envelope calculations. It's over half. More than half of railroad accidents that occur have some form of human failure involved in them, yes.
So more than half. How does that line up with, say, the airline industry, for instance? Because, you know, trains and planes are both ways that we move around the country. We take an awful lot of flights, and we have an awful lot of safeguards in place to make sure that those planes are safe. And we have an awful lot of standardized training in place to make sure that the pilots are the very best. When we saw this terrible accident that happened when a single pilot decided to crash a plane into the French Alps, it shocked the world in part because it never, ever happens. So how similar or different is the training for those who drive trains as those who drive planes?
Well, you know, I'm both a pilot and I have been a qualified locomotive engineer in the past, so I can certainly address your question. Both industries are heavily regulated, both at the federal and the state level. And there are specific criteria that are in place for locomotive engineer qualification. For instance, locomotive engineers today have to be federally certified, and they have to renew that federal certification every 3 years. That includes a written test, typically a road test, where their knowledge of physical characteristics of the line they operate on is tested, and also a medical examination every 3 years. So it's somewhat similar to that of pilots, although in the commercial aviation arena, airplanes, large commercial airliners, are much more automated in their functionality than are railroad locomotives. For instance, you know, most commercial airliners can land and take off pretty much on their own, unless the pilot specifically takes over command. Not so in the rail industry, even with positive train control. We're still going to have human operators on the trains.
But why exactly is that? I mean, lay people looking at this would say It's almost this magic miracle that gigantic jet planes get up in the air and land almost completely in an automated fashion. But yet, on the ground where we can see what's in front of us, we can know the terrain, and we can know a lot of the characteristics of the route, we're not able to completely automate the train system. Why that disconnect, Robert?
There's really two systems that need to be fully developed in order to implement full automation. And one of them is positive train control, the part that we're working on now. The other part is that we need really good machine vision. The locomotive has to be able to see situations that are developing ahead of it. For instance, a pedestrian approaching the tracks or a vehicle or another train of some kind. It needs to be able to assess whether that object is a potential threat based on its current course and speed. And if so, it needs to make the determination as to what needs to be done. And we really don't have such a system so far. Although, a lot of the technology that's currently being developed for self-driving automobiles by Google and others probably will have direct application in the rail industry. So I think that part of the technology is going to start to move here sometime probably within the next decade or so.
Stephen, I'd like for you to pick up on that, and I'm glad that he just mentioned the self-driving car or even cars that have enhanced driving features. Look, if you can spend $50,000 on a Lexus or a Mercedes that tells you if somebody's driving too close to you or parks itself, it seems as though having a really expensive locomotive see, a little bit down the track might not be the hardest thing in the world to do.
Well, you could equip the locomotives with target acquisition. And then basically target acquisition would be a use of a radar system, infrared system forward on the train. We could implant sensors on the track for trespassers. As Robert knows, target acquisition is used in aircraft by our military, and it can be also applied in this particular case.
It seems as though the technology is there, is what you're saying.
The technology, it would be a combination of technologies that we would have to use. We would have to make sure that the current applications for automatic train control or centralized train control is used with PTC, positive train control. And then we could add additional applications to the trains. But this costs money and time. And we don't have the money or the time right now.
Robert Halstead, by way of benchmarking against other countries, I assume that all these super high-speed trains that we see in Europe or Japan, they have all these bells and whistles that we've been talking about?
By and large, in one form or another, yes.
Mm-hmm. And essentially, are they dealing with technology that is far superior to ours? Is it just about investment in the same technology? Is there something very specifically different about how, European or Asian trains roll at very high speeds than we're able to do here?
One of the biggest differences between their systems and ours is that, by and large, their systems operate on dedicated trackage. In other words, the high-speed passenger train is essentially the only thing that operates on that line. They don't have any slow-moving freight trains to deal with. And that really makes a huge difference because when you have dedicated trackage, for one, you can protect it better. You can use improved means of trespasser detection and ways to keep them off the railroad. You can remove grade crossings insofar as possible. And you don't have to deal with slower-moving trains that do more track damage, and therefore need to be maintained more frequently in order to maintain the high speed. So there are significant differences between their system and ours here in the U.S.
Do you have some thoughts, Stephen?
Right. On that, I agree with Robert explicitly that the dedicated track is actually a way to go for high-speed rail. We don't have dedicated track for high-speed rail at all. And that's a problem here in the United States. We have multi-mode mixture for our freight and our passenger service. We have crossings at inopportune times that are going different places. Amtrak experiences that all the time.
In Connecticut alone, we're driving these trains with people or freight over bridges sometimes that are 115 years old and haven't been maintained probably as well as they should be.
Well, in Connecticut, we have a problem. We need bridges replaced, and we're doing that right now. Connecticut Department of Transportation is replacing bridges. It takes a lot of time to replace a bridge. You want your service to continue as you're replacing the bridge, so you need to develop runarounds at the bridges, maybe add additional interlockings. The cost escalates as you go to do the maintenance on it.
We're going to be talking about cost coming up next. We're going to bring in Senator Richard Blumenthal, who's going to talk a little bit about how we can find more funding to do this and do it quickly. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can also tweet us at Where We Live and find us on Facebook at Where We Live as we talk about rail safety in the Northeast here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Today we're talking about rail safety in the light of the Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia, which occurred a week ago. We're talking with some rail safety experts, Stephen Segedy, who's a former electrical engineer with the Connecticut DOT. He also represented Connecticut's DOT to Metro North's Positive Train Control Committee. Positive Train Control, of course, one of the things that's in the news that we're talking about. Another expert, Robert Halstead, joins us from WAER in Syracuse today. I also want to bring in Richard Blumenthal. He's the senator from Connecticut, and he's been very vocal on these issues. And, Senator, welcome back to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be back.
We heard from Anna Radilat, who covers Washington for the Connecticut Mirror, earlier about the costs involved. There are politics involved. First of all, Senator, I'll just ask you, what's the biggest holdup to getting positive train control on all the rails in America, most specifically in Connecticut and the Northeast?
Combination of regulatory capture and railroad resistance are the two main factors that have blocked positive train control. Regulatory capture involves the Federal Railway Administration, which is supposed to be the watchdog and passenger protector, but it's had neither bark nor bite. In fact, it's been a captive of the railroads. It's failed to implement the recommendation of the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, recommended decades ago that positive train control be instituted, but the FRA has failed to order that recommendation. And second, railroad resistance basically on cost. Some of the railroads, ironically, Amtrak being one of them, have invested in positive train control. Others are moving forward, like the MTA, which recently received a loan from the federal government to institute positive train control. But most of the railroads in the country, particularly freight, have not done so, and that imperils the entire rail system.
Well,
a little bit like air traffic control.
Well, okay, so air traffic control. We were talking about airplanes earlier. If there was a crash of a commercial airline, Senator, and we found out that there was some specific shortfall, some shortcoming in technology that we said all commercial airliners need to have now, Congress would step in, the FAA would step in, and I assume that it would be fixed. Why doesn't it work that way with the railroads?
First, we're having a hearing this morning on FAA reauthorization that will highlight some of the glaring needs in air traffic control that have not been met. There's technology that needs to be implemented in the air as well as in railroads. But the fact of the matter is that there's something reassuring about being on the ground, being on tracks, being in a car that seems very familiar, that perhaps deprives the rail safety issue of some of the urgency and immediacy that it deserves. But you're absolutely right that these kinds of crashes, killing 8 people in Philadelphia and other people in Spuyten Duyvil in the Bronx about a year ago, and of course in Bridgeport there was a derailment, which is a separate issue involving the decaying, decrepit infrastructure, our tracks and aging equipment in the Northeast, but the lack of attention and investment. Investment is key. Even if we move forward with investigation, we need investment. And that requires a relatively modest amount of money compared to the cost. The cost-benefit analysis clearly shows we need positive train control.
Okay, so the cost-benefit analysis, obviously we're talking about billions of dollars that we need to spend over a very short period of time. We also, of course, have a system in Congress right now, Senator, that doesn't seem amenable to working these sorts of things out. When Anna Radulat was on earlier, she was talking about some of the politics behind this. Republican senators getting behind a plan to push out the mandate for positive train control for reasons including, you know, how much it's going to cost and how much time the railroad industry would have. I know politics is going to play a little bit of a piece of this, but, you know, Democrats, whether they're in the White House or in Congress, haven't really fully funded this thing either. I mean, how do we get to the type of funding that we need and the mandates that we need around train safety?
The blame is bipartisan. Some of my colleagues on the Democratic side have opposed positive train control and, in fact, urged delay. Some of them are from the same states as Republicans opposing prompt implementation of positive train control. And we need bipartisanship on the other side, on our side as well. That's what I'm trying to do, build a coalition. Because obviously safety on the rails should not be about Republican or Democrat. And it hasn't been in the past. So the solution here is really to develop the kind of awareness that you're doing on this show that we need done all around the country so that my colleagues realize that we can no longer patch and pray, patch the system, fix the problems temporarily, and pray it'll be enough, because clearly that approach is inadequate. And we will either pay now or we'll pay later, because talking about billions of dollars, it sounds like a lot of money, but believe me, this crash in Philadelphia is ultimately going to cost billions of dollars. The injuries, the deaths, the repair of the railroad itself are all going to cost billions of dollars, not to mention the delay and the economic damage that has been caused, $100 million a day as the railroad has been shut down.
Why should there be any delay on the installation of positive train control on trains in America? I mean, why a five-year delay, a three-year delay, a one-year delay? Why not just say, we need to do this now, we need to spend a whole bunch of money, and we need to make sure that the trains are safe?
The system is not simple and straightforward any more than GPS, as simple as we believe it is now. We rely on it. We take it for granted almost. But GPS obviously relies on satellites and spectrum and frequency being available, and so does this system. And so one of the obstacles, going back to your initial question, has been the scarcity of FCC spectrum, that is the radio frequencies that are necessary, the airwaves, for this system to operate, because switches, signals depend on the sensors and the transponders on the tracks and the transmitters that go to the rails. It's a relatively complex system, but at the end of the day, what Amtrak has done and what every railroad needs to do is to have the spectrum available. And so far, the FCC has been more an obstacle than a change agent here, and that's why pressure on all of these federal agencies, whether it's the FRA or the FCC, is necessary, along with the dollars.
And can you and Congress, I mean, can you put more pressure on the FCC? This seems like a really, really important thing. These are indeed our public airwaves, and however we use them to best keep people safe, to make sure that we have, whether it's the information we need or positive train control on our rail lines, it seems as though that's something that probably needs to be fixed pretty quickly.
Yes, we are bringing pressure on the FCC, and yes, it is having an effect, but still, yes, we need more pressure to be brought to bear, and that's what I'm trying to do. In addition, I've seen a sea change in opinion, an attitude on the part of my colleagues. They are realizing, I think, that delay in positive train control is intolerable and unacceptable. You're right. It should be done tomorrow, and there should be a national initiative, a real push from the president, frankly, and the Department of Transportation to make sure that we have the safest railroads possible. And remember, John, that this problem is really symptomatic of a broader issue. This nation is failing to invest in our roads and bridges and airports and ports and, yes, our railroads. We spend less than 2% of our GDP on infrastructure compared to Europe with 5% and China with 9%. Those statistics, I'm sure, have been on your show before. They've become commonplace, but they evidence the lack of commitment and investment.
While I have you for another couple of minutes, Senator, I'm wondering if Robert Halstead, who's a trained safety expert who joins us from Syracuse, has any thoughts at all, Robert, on either the politics behind some of this or the payment, the cost on some of this? I mean, anything that, you're thinking about as we talk to the senator about the problems that we need to overcome?
Well, as the senator mentioned, cost is one of the big issues here. I personally am not in favor of any extension in the implementation time for PTC, although if the delay faction does gain critical mass, I would prefer that that delay be as short as possible. I've heard some proposals to extend it for another 5 years beyond where we are now. Personally, I think that's far too long. If there is an extension at all, I would like to see it be a year or even less.
And, John, my proposal essentially is to, if necessary, extend it only for a year, and that's railroad by railroad on a showing that each railroad would have to make that it is impossible for them to do right away. In other words, there may be an issue specific to a railroad that prevents them from accomplishing it by the deadline of 2015, but that should be just for a year. And it should be on a factual showing that it is absolutely necessary. And then if there's another justification for another year, that should be taken in the same way. But railroads generally should be held to meet that deadline. Their feet should be held to the fire. The five-year extension, which really could turn into a seven-year extension, as Mr. Hull has said, I think is intolerable and unacceptable. That's the delay that was passed by the Commerce Committee, but I'm hoping that my colleagues now we'll have a change of mind and adopt the kind of measure that I have proposed, which would, for most railroads, mean implementation right away, as Amtrak has promised to do by the end of 2015.
Stephen Segedy, a quick thought while we've got the senator here.
Good morning, Senator. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. And Robert, I agree with you. I agree with you both that, you know, a long delay is not in the benefit of everybody here. You know, I mean, we need to acquire certain frequencies, and we have to acquire the frequencies county by county. The state of Connecticut still needs to acquire Fairfield and New Haven counties and adjacent counties so there's any frequency overbleed. And that's one of the problems that we have. We need to address these problems, and as you are doing with the FCC, holding their feet to the fire.
Senator, before I let you go, I just have to ask, you know, and you've made this economic case, you know, talking about $100 million a day lost because of this track shutdown, all of the costs that go into, you know, what happens when a major rail line like this is shut down. I've said this over and over again. One way to get movement in Connecticut is if you talk about how it's going to hit people's pocketbooks. Fairfield County, where you're from, relies on train service, whether it's Metro North, Amtrak service. It seems as though there may be a case to be made for people in Connecticut to really get behind some big changes, the ones that need to happen at the federal level, but also the ones that need to happen right here in our state as far as our investment. We own a lot of these tracks, sir.
We own a lot of the tracks, and the tracks go over bridges that are, as you said earlier in the show, 100, 150 years old. The Walk Bridge in Norwalk was built when Grover Cleveland was president, and the other bridges, there are four of them, are also nearly that old, 100 years old. And so investment is key, but you're absolutely right. The argument really can be brought back to the pocketbook. Even if you don't care about the lives and injuries, and most people do care about them, certainly I do, you should care about the dollars. And we have to realize that rail transportation is essential to our economy. $100 million a day is lost just because the rail is shut down, not even measuring the broader implications to our national economy. That's the cost to our regional Northeast economy. And so there are huge opportunities lost to us because we have not invested in rail as we should. Other countries are doing it. It's the reason that they have recognized global competition is essential to their doing so. And so I think that the pocketbook, dollars and cents, should argue strongly, patch and pray, no longer enough. We need to really pay now or we're going to pay later.
Richard Blumenthal, Senator from Connecticut, thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before we head to break, I need to ask a question of Robert Halstead. We got a good tweet from Jeff who says, please ask your guest why in the world engineers are allowed to have cell phones or texting devices in the cab. This is something that we've seen before in train accidents elsewhere, not necessarily in America. Are there any rules around that, Robert Halstead?
Yes. Most railroads in the last 5 to 7 years, give or take, have instituted operating rules that require any personal cell phones that are carried by the crew to be in the off position and stowed in their bag throughout the course of their tour of duty.
And as far as rules of who's in the cabin and not, there's a minimum number of engineers in the cabin. Anything like what we see in commercial airlines where, you know, you have to have a pilot and a co-pilot. And again, as we've seen in this terrible accident in the French Alps, you know, you have a situation where somebody gets locked out of the cab, and what are the rules around that?
Well, most Amtrak passenger trains, for instance, short-distance trains, have just an engineer and a conductor. And the engineer is in the cab, and the conductor is back in the train with the passengers. Longer-distance Amtrak trains have the same single engineer in a cab, conductor back in the train, and perhaps a couple of assistant conductors, otherwise called trainmen, that are back there to assist the conductor. But that's it. By and large, you have one person in the cab, and that's it currently.
Stephen, should that change?
Well, physically, you only have room, usually, depending on commuter trains, you only have room for one individual within the cab for the operator. The Amtrak engineers, on the Amtrak trains, you can bring a second person on board, but there isn't really any room. I mean, Robert, you've ridden the head end of a train, and there's no room for anybody up there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've ridden the head end, and it's amazing. I mean, before a lot of the crossings were removed on the Northeast Corridor, I rode an Amtrak train up there, and I thought every single car was going to run across the crossing, and the engineer he'd tell you which one was going to run right in front of them until we started removing them.
My goodness. As you start to talk about more and more of this stuff, you start to wonder why we can't make some more investments to change some of the things that we probably can use to help our system be safer. We're talking with Stephen Segedy. He's a former electrical engineer for the CTDOT, also a former Connecticut State DOT representative to Metro North's Positive Train Control Committee. It's one of the things we're exploring today. Also with Robert Halstead, we're talking about how exactly we make a safer train system here in the Northeast. As we come back from a break, a chance for you to ask some questions of these train experts, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266, or tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, President Obama is coming to New London to address graduating cadets at the Coast Guard. Will his message sound anything like the one Vice President Biden gave Yale grads to find their sweet spot in life? Coming up on the next Where We Live, it's our news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We'll talk about the president's trip. We'll also talk about the use of the word racist in political speech. Hope you can join us for that conversation. Today on the program, we're talking about rail safety with two rail safety experts. Robert Halstead joins us from WAER in Syracuse, railroad signal and accident reconstruction expert with Ironwood Technologies in Syracuse, New York. Stephen Segedy is a former electrical engineer for the Connecticut DOT. We're taking some of your calls as well. Let's go to Dave in Berlin. Hi there, Dave. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Look, I just want to say that I think that most of this money we spend on rail, passenger rail, is a waste of time. We get 80 people killed every day in car wrecks, and much more people injured every day in car wrecks. And the passenger, our commercial rail system is one of the safest in the world, and our passenger rail system isn't invested in because it's not paid for itself. It's not owned by companies. It's just a draw on the government. It's kind of an overfunded government, underfunded government organization. And they use this, like, occasional burst of, you know, injuries and that sort of thing to say, oh, we just need more money to feed some more bureaucrats.
That's
my thought on this.
Well, Dave, I just have a quick question for you. If indeed the roads are unsafe and we end up with a lot of people killed in cars and the trains are more safe, wouldn't we, by the very nature of the numbers you cited, save more lives by moving more people to rail travel as opposed to car travel?
You know, I think that's actually a good point, except that we've been trying to do that for years, light rail, low rail. There's something in Hartford, Connecticut, where they created this fast-track bus system, $600 million for it to try and get people off the roadways. It just doesn't work. People like the independence of being able to get in their car and go where they want, when they want.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for your phone call. I guess, Robert Halstead, I'll ask you to comment a little bit on what he's talking about, you know, whether or not we're making the right investments at all. Part of the thing we've heard is we can't pay for the rail system because we don't have enough ridership, and there's a chicken and egg problem right there for you.
Well, you know, to the best of my knowledge, there's no national rail system anywhere in the world that is entirely self-supporting through its own revenue. They're all supported by government input at some point or another, either through dedicated trackage or through assistance on the trackage that they do operate on. So it's not a, you know, it's not a private corporation. I don't think it will ever be one. But I think it's one that we need to support nonetheless.
I want to get to Chuck in Norwalk. And Dave, thanks again for your call. Hey, Chuck, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm curious why we have any human being driving the train to begin with. It seems to me that we have computer control systems that can fly airplanes and can, self-drive cars and detect issues. And it always seems to be human error that causes the problem. Why don't we get rid of the people on the trains to begin with and let the computers run them?
Well, it's a fair question, and Chuck, thanks very much for it. And Stephen, so we talked about this a little bit earlier. It seems as though the technology exists to be able to do a lot of this, maybe without any people or maybe a smaller number of people. How do you answer Chuck?
Well, Chuck, you know, we could develop automated rail systems. I think that if you go to some amusement areas, they have small automated rail systems that operate, but we don't have the funding currently to put a large national or regional automated rail system in, and I don't think the people so far trust an automated rail system to operate. You always want a human there because you're comforted by that human being there.
Comforted by it, but I mean, if we're just looking at the law of numbers that Robert Halstead's talking about, if about half of the crashes that ever happen are because of human error, that makes me somewhat less comfortable.
Well, we still have a pilot in an aircraft. You know, without if the system fails, you're going to want to have somebody there.
Well, it gets to something you were talking about actually before the break, and it gets to something you've been working on quite a bit, which is these at-grade crossings, right? We haven't been able to eliminate the fact that in various places across our state and all around the country, an Amtrak train or another freight train will go across a roadway, and the barriers will come down, and the traffic should stop. But every once in a while, someone will try to go around the barriers because they got to, you know, pick up their kid from school and get stuck on the track, and some terrible thing happens. So what have you done to try to mitigate some of the problems there in terms of these crossings, which are a fact of life still?
Okay. In 1998, I developed a quad gate rail crossing with a federal grant of $1 million. It was an 80-20 grant. The state contributed $200,000. And what I did is develop the four-gate system with vehicle detection and train control. We interfaced the loop detection system into the cab signal system of the trains, and we were able to functionally stop, blockade a crossing, and if a vehicle was within the protected area of the crossing, it would send a signal if the crossing was activated to the train, and the engineer would respond within so many seconds, either downgrade his speed, bring the train to a stop, or if the crossing was again clear, he could proceed at normal track speed. We also made it so that the vehicle that was detected within the crossing had an exit gate that it wouldn't be trapped in the crossing. We did something that we use now. Amtrak uses it on the Northeast Corridor, uses it in Illinois. It's used different parts of the country. It was a contribution to society.
And yours is in Mystic. How many of these are around the state or around the region?
We have all of the crossings in Connecticut that Amtrak crosses on the Northeast Corridor are equipped with quad gates and vehicle detection with train control. Amtrak uses it on a number of crossings in Illinois. It's used on different crossings in one form or another throughout parts of California. Amtrak has used it. There's variations of it that are used in different states and North Carolina on different lines. It hasn't been fully adopted. It's about $1.5 million to $2 million a crossing, depending on what has to be done at the crossing.
So getting rid of some of these at-grade crossings or improving them is one of the things that we've talked about, Robert. We just have a couple minutes left, but here I'm going to bring us to a slightly simpler one. Why don't you have to wear a seatbelt on a train like you do on a plane?
Well, I think the principal problem with seatbelt implementation is simply getting a sufficiently high percentage of passengers to wear them. It's no problem putting seatbelts on a train. You don't have any weight considerations like you do if you put them on a commercial airliner. But, in fact, last week I saw a national survey that indicated that 71% of the respondents did not want seatbelts on a train, and if they were there, they wouldn't wear them. So, again, I think that's more of a human factors issue as to why we don't have them than anything else.
But again, very much like the conversation we had earlier about how planes and trains are different but maybe should be the same, there's usually a very nice man or woman who walks up and down the aisle and says, sir, if you don't put your seatbelt on, the pilot's not going to take off. So you should probably put your seatbelt on and stow your tray table, et cetera, et cetera. Why can't we do the same thing with a train, Stephen?
I commuted for many years from Connecticut to New York. Okay, commuting on a commuter train during the holiday season, you're lucky you can get a place to stand on the train. I mean, you know, there's no rule. When you get a ticket for a train, there's nothing that guarantees you, unless you have a reserved seat on an Amtrak, a regional train, guarantees you a ticket, a seat. So you may be standing on Metro North trains, depending on.
And once again, they never hardly ever take off a plane. You know, a U.S. Air flight down to Washington, D.C. with a bunch of people standing up holding on to little ropes, right?
Right.
It doesn't happen that way. And again, it seems as though, not that it would solve all the problems, but a number of the people who were thrown about during this train derailment may have very well been either had their lives saved or had injuries forestalled because they were strapped in. And that's, again, something that we're just deciding not to do.
Yeah, that's it's a human factor. You know, we don't want to be constrained. We want our freedom.
Right. We want our freedom, and we want to drive in the cars, which, as our earlier caller said, is much less safe. We just have a couple minutes left, Robert. If you had a chance to change something about any of the stuff we've talked about, one solution right now that would make our rail system safer, Robert Halstead, what would it be?
I think a renewed focus on basic maintenance. We've seen a number of accidents that have been caused by broken rails, by operating rules, compliance issues. That is something that would not cost a huge amount of money to implement and could be done fairly quickly. So I would start with that while continuing emphasis on capital projects such as positive train control.
Stephen, how about you? One thing you get a chance to sit in front of Congress and say, this is the thing you got to fix right now.
I want to invest in an infrastructure that is suitable for the time we live. Not one that's 150 years old and that is patchwork.
Isn't that part of the problem with trains? There's this feeling of nostalgia about the rails that we maybe don't have for a lot of things that were built, not 115 years ago. And maybe that's one of the things that's holding us back a little bit.
Well, if you like nostalgia for rails, you can take a scenic train anywhere you want. But if you're going to be on a commuter or a high-speed train or commuting between New York and Washington, D.C., or New York and Boston, I want it to be safe. I want an investment put in it. I mean, it's not just an investment in a train infrastructure. We need an investment in our highways, our bridges, our power system. We don't even have enough power to do all this. I mean, our communication system is fairly decent, but in 10 years, if we don't even invest in that, we're going to have problems.
Stephen Segedy is a former electrical engineer for the Connecticut DOT. Thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate your expertise.
You're welcome.
Thanks also to Robert Halstead, a railroad signal and accident reconstruction expert. He joined us from WAER in Syracuse. He's from Ironwood Technologies. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Our program was produced today by Josh Nalea. Thanks to Kion Wolf and Betsy Kaplan, Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown, our executive producers, Katie Solarski. Thanks also to our digital editor, Heather Brandon, for her help today. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.